The Church's Middle Eastern Adventure, a downloadable audio tour. The Olana Partnership's downloadable audio tour program is designed to give the museum and park visitors a unique view into the archives at Olana. This program makes public for the first time letters and journal entries from Frederick and Isabel Church's extensive travels in the Middle East in the late 1860s. Specifically, you will hear from an edited collection of Church letters and journal entries from Isabel's diary. As part of the larger digital humanities program in development at Olana, the 2018 audio tour links to themes in our exhibition titled Costume and Custom, the Middle Eastern Threads at Olana, designed to illuminate the travels that inspired both Olana and many works of art by Church for years to come. The name Olana resonates with the family's Middle Eastern adventures. For many years, the churches called their property simply the farm. The name Olana first appeared written Olane as a heading in a letter written by Isabel Church. A contemporary newspaper article credited her as the originator of the name of the house, explaining the old Latin name for a place in Persia to which the artist's home bears some resemblance in situation. Scholars have linked the name to a translated volume of Strabo's Geographica, a Christmas gift from Isabel to Frederick in 1879. Strabo's publication described the geography of the Roman Empire and referenced the city of Olane as one of the treasure house storehouses on the Arxus River, which offered beautiful views of Mount Ararat, where Noah's Ark was said to rest. It is likely that the churches appreciated the associations this name had to their own Persian-inspired stone fortress situated high above the Hudson River with majestic views west to America's promised land. Church playfully called his house Persian, adapted to the Occident. Many design details are adapted from Middle Eastern sources, including the arched windows, balcony woodwork, and tilework. In overall form, however, the house resembles many other 19th century villas, with joined blocks of massing and picturesque fashion, a corner tower, and a Mansfield roof with pronounced cornices. The following audio tour creates access to the voices and experiences of the churches while traveling through many regions in the Middle East. It can be listened to on a bench on site while looking at the architecture and the landscape, or it can be downloaded or streamed anywhere. If you're listening on site, we encourage earphone use or certainly low volume so as not to interrupt the quiet of our other visitors. The audio tour is about 1 hour in length, both by Church and by Isabel, and can be stopped and started at any time. The Olana Partnership wishes to thank site manager Kimberly Fluck for her support in editing this content, and the collections at the Olana State Historic Site who own and care for Church's collections through the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. Thanks to Amy Huffnagel, the Director of Education at TOP, for the production and direction of this tour, as well as our talented local actors, Anne Underland and Jim Frangoni. Anne is an actor and a playwright who lives in Chatham, New York, and Jim is an actor and playwright who has performed hundreds of audiobooks and is also the co-artistic director of the Berkshire Playwrights Lab in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The Olana Partnership is pleased to work with the expert team at Wave Farm and WGXC and their talented team of sound artists and engineers. Please join us in thanking the members of the Olana Partnership and our Board of Trustees for their ongoing support of our educational work. If you enjoy this digital programming, please make note of it when you fill out our visitor survey. Tell your friends, and we hope you'll consider becoming a member of TOP to support the archive and our work in making it public. Please note, pronouncing certain words of places recorded by the churches was an interesting challenge. Sometimes words were spelled phonetically, other times regionally accurate. This recording holds true to the church spellings and their historic uses.
Saw a lady who had traveled from Cairo to Mount Sinai and soon to Petra, etc., on a donkey, 40 days in the desert on the donkey. Saw the Jerome party, a rough-looking set. They were driven from their tents on arriving at Jerusalem on account of the rain, cold, and wind. They had also been to Petra, very much disgusted with the Bedouin, who treated them, it must be confessed, in not a very polite manner, presenting guns at the cook, insisting upon eating up food intended for the dragoman and servants. Also, when the Jeromes were departing for more friendly regions, these terrible Bedouins threatened to take the life of the dragoman if he did not give them more backsheesh. So they were compelled to give the wretches an enormous sum in addition to what they had already given. Strange that these same Bedouin should have been so easily managed by Fred's dragoman, Mikajel Herney, only a very short time previous to these troubles of the Jeromes. Encamped on Mount of Olives for one night, to taste a little of camp life, it was very cold, but clear and beautiful, and I, for one, was fascinated with tent life, and wished very much to have been able to travel by land through the country, to have passed through much more of such lovely scenes. It was moonlight, and Jerusalem lay spread out before us, looking silvery and mysteriously grand. We had a very nice dinner just before sunset in the pretty tent, Miss Hoadley and Mr. Johnson being our companions, our old cook from Bellamy, Beirut, officiating, and a most excellent waiter. After dinner, we walked up to near the top of Olivet, and sitting under an immense olive tree, the gentlemen gathered some dry brush and built us a bonfire. How we did enjoy its warmth and the beautiful, brilliant tongues of flame produced. After having enjoyed to the full this novel evening, we retired to our separate tents, Miss H. and I occupying one together. It was so cold we found it very difficult to sleep, but then I did not say so. I thought Miss H.'s complaints of her bed pillow and of the cold were out of place upon Olivet, where once our Savior wondered, not knowing where to lay his head, whilst we were comparatively so warmly and comfortably located in our nice tent. Of course, we read appropriate portions of the New Testament, and very sweet and sad and solemn they seemed. We heard the jackals in the distance, and the hoarse murmur of the Arab guards seems to continue all night. The next morning, we were all up early, and enjoying the view of Jerusalem, lighted up by the morning sun. Our breakfast tasted delightfully, eaten in the pretty tent, and the fresh morning air coming in to sharpen our appetites. Dear conscientious Fred felt that he must remain and try to finish his sketch, but the rest of us mounted some excellent horses, and with Rule as guide, rode on through the Valley of Jehoshaphat, past Absalom's tomb, etc., past the village of Siloam, and through the valley of Hinnom, Thepet, and Al-Sadema, and so on, through the plain of Rephaim, where the Philistines were routed by David. And very soon we reached Bethlehem. We went to the Church of the Nativity, and were shown the place where, as the monks told us, our Savior was laid in the manger. We were rather incredulous about this. This church was built by the Empress Helena and is said to be the oldest monument of Christian architecture in the world. There are 40 columns supporting the old decaying roof, each one solid piece of marble. We saw many devotees prostrating themselves before these pillars and kissing the floor. Why they did so, we did not learn. Bethlehem is a Christian community, but Roman Catholic, of course. We were surrounded, of course, as we left the church, by a rabble of boys and men, urging us to purchase their mother-of-pearl crosses, beads, silk minders, etc., and were inveigled by one of the wretches up a very steep, winding stone stairs to the top of some building, where he hoped to make a fortune out of us, I suppose, in which he was bitterly disappointed, for we were quite hard-hearted and utterly refused to pay the exorbitant prices he asked. The view from this elevated place was very fine, of the Dead Sea, mountains of Moab, etc., and Bethlehem spread out before us. We rode back to Jerusalem by the same road, passing the tomb of Rachel. She certainly was buried very near here, and it was through these plains somewhere that Ruth met Boaz, and all that beautiful story came up before us. As we approached the city of the great king, near the Jaffa gate, There was an Arab procession, and some wild dancing, and still wilder music. It had a certain weird sort of fascination for me. The next morning we were up very early and started on very poor horses for Ramle. We were wonderfully favored as to weather, it being just pleasantly overcast the whole distance. Mr. and Mrs. Terry from Irvington, a Mr. and Mrs. Dole, Dr. Lancy and Burlingham we met on the road, and joined us. Mr. and Mrs. T are lovely Christian people, and we had a merry ride. Mr. Dole is a Unitarian missionary to India, had been absent many years, returning to his family. A peculiar man, all the time taking notes about everything the most trivial. Reached Jaffa next day about 10 in morning, passing through the delicious orange groves which border the entire land side of the ancient city, lending a poetic charm to Jaffa, which is certainly dispelled when you fairly enter the city with its dirt, smells, etc. We were taken to a convent, which was high up on the upper ridge of the city, and from which there was a noble view. Mrs. Terry, Miss H., and I were ushered into a room up many flights of stairs containing 6 beds. We were told we could not have breakfast for more than 10 hours. Therefore, not having had anything more substantive than an egg and coffee at 6:30 that morning, and after our ride feeling the need of something, we ordered some oranges brought in, and we eat 3 apiece. We were just disposing ourselves for a nice rest when we were summoned to depart instantly, as the wind was rising and there were fears lest, the sea becoming rough, the steamer might leave without us. So we were hurried off, just as our much-needed breakfast was being served. We had a pretty rough row to the vessel, and there found, to our dismay, that not one mouthful of food could be got in that wretchedly French ship until 5 o'clock. Not even a cup of tea. I felt revengefully inclined towards the whole French nation. Of course, when 5 o'clock did, we were far too faint to eat, and consequently I was very seasick. Poor Fred felt wretchedly. Oh, beautiful Beirut looked, although there was a sprinkling of rain. And how rejoiced and very thankful I felt to get back in safety to my dear mother and precious baby, and to find them both so well. It was indeed a happy morning. Our rooms looked quite palatial, and so pretty, and Mama had on a stand in one of the windows some earthenware carafes with seeds spread over them, which had sprouted and were beautiful. Damascus, April 24, 1868. Reached here last evening about 6 o'clock, after a cool and not very fatiguing ride in the coupe of diligence. Much of the scenery very fine, and from the last station to Damascus, the views were beyond all I had heard or read of their beauty. This inexpressibly lovely valley, so green and fertile, with the swiftly flowing Barada, fringed with a sort of poplar, hawthorn, roses, etc., and the desolate mountains of Anti-Lebanon as a strong contrast to all this fairy loveliness, formed pictures of rare beauty. Before we reached the city, we came suddenly upon an Arabian Nights-looking house, built close to water's edge. A circular marble portico with marble pillars and a fountain playing in the center. Seated in the place, one might dip one's hand in the river flowing so swiftly past. The most beautiful verdure surrounded this enchanted spot, and though the decorations of the mansion were gaudy, yet seen thus toward sunset, and so momentarily as we, from the coupe window, saw it, it was wonderfully lovely. The broad road was, from this point, hedged in on either side by a dense vegetation, and the air was fragrant with the perfume of the hawthorn. Glimpses of the river and of the mountains we caught over and over. As we approached the city, we passed more and more frequently groups of turbaned Turks, and picturesque costumed individuals of different nations, and swift little white donkeys with crimson saddles and trappings, and with their coats all cut into various patterns, and with old quaint-looking Turks astride them. The sun shone with a glorious radiance through the dark clouds upon the domes and minarets of Damascus, upon the swift river and verdant plain, and the mountains looked dark and forbidding in contrast. The walk from the custom house to this hotel, Dimitri Aras, was pretty, quaint, and picturesque in the extreme. Damascus, gay, oriental, and picturesque in spite of the mud houses, narrow, dirty, and in most places gloomy streets. Some very large trees, one enormous one. Trees and water flowing from formations in every direction under city seemingly cool and pleasant. Long streets of bazaars, covered over from side to side. Within some streets, a stone roofing with arches, but generally with curious, intricate roofing of wood. In some, latticework and vines trained over, very pretty. Bazaars seem interminable, whole streets sometimes devoted to selling one article. Carpet and silk bazaars often up many stairs. Bathhouses seen everywhere, and passers-by can see the ghost-like bathers enjoying themselves after their fashion. Generally, Turkish towels hang out to dry across street before such places. Curious cookshops. At one, they were roasting a nice-looking piece of meat before a strange-looking, upright, open sort of arrangement with fire quite visible. Turned meat on spit, and as the outside cooked, the cook cut off slices of it and sold it to whosoever wished it. Some English travelers told me they tasted a slice and found it very nice indeed. Dogs without number lying round, fast asleep during day, but make night hideous with their howling and barking. A nuisance. Interior of Damascus houses a great contrast to exterior. Enter by a low, narrow door. Even I had to stoop to go through. And there, after passing through a small court, you find yourself in a large court paved with marble, white mosaiced with colored marble, with fountains playing, and flowers and orange and lemon trees making a pleasant shade and perfume. On one side, a room entirely open on courtside, with raised dais, divans, and decorated. Then many other rooms opening by smallish door on court. All these rooms have fountains, daises, divans, mirrors, etc. Walls and ceiling highly and gorgeously decorated, with mirrors everywhere. Amid the decorations, little bits of mirrors, doors, and all woodwork inlaid with ivory and mother of pearl. At night, by candlelight, the effect must be quite splendid. One is reminded of Arabian Nights tales in this oriental magnificence, and indeed in all the Turks, Arabs, etc. one meets. Left Damascus on morning of 27th for the Hauran to visit some of the famous giant cities of Bashan. Mr. Wright and Mr. Robeson, two Irishmen, Protestant missionaries here, and an English clergyman, a Mr. Wright, traveler with ourselves, formed the party. For safety in that desert country, we had as guard a sheikh from a village near Damascus, and the other Arab, wild-looking, splendidly mounted, and heavily armed men. In that, with Nejem, Star, our dragoman, with his camels and muleteers, we made quite a formidable-looking cavalcade. We made our first halting place among some trees, near a village, Neja, entered by the Awej, the Abana Farpar of the Bible. Here we took lunch, and then pushed on through the desert, sun leaving all signs of vegetation behind us, with the exception of a very scant kind of grass, and now and then some dwarf gray sort of bush. The sunny Hermon, in all its beauty, was the only lovely thing for our eyes to rest upon during the whole ride. This plain of the Hauran is an almost uninhabitable desert, For that reason, since, once it was cultivated, and in most places the soil being rich, it would still yield abundant crops if the Bedouin, with their devastating raids, did not drive the poor people who would cultivate it away. After traveling about 5 hours, we saw the sheikh, and two of the gentlemen who had ridden on with him, a little in advance of us, halt, and as we came up to them, we heard Mr. Wright say, "Well, this is a very terrible thing," and he pointed down to a loose mass of stones and earth with some rags scattered here and there and human bones, only half buried, and the jawbone of a man, etc. The sheikh told him that there had been, quite recently, 4 men murdered by the Bedouin for their animals and clothing and buried here. This was a cheering prospect for us. I was very much alarmed, and I think the gentlemen were decidedly more serious after this. And I noticed the sheikh and his men were very watchful, glancing continually in all directions. Presently, as we approached a small hill, Mr. Wright exclaimed, "What is that on the top of the hill? It moves. I must look through my glass." My heart seemed to stand still with fright, but it proved to be only a bear. Wild animals seemed as nothing compared to the fierce Bedouin, mounted on thin, swift steeds, and with their formidable-looking spears, etc. But God in his mercy kept us in safety, and brought us in peace to Barak, the first ruined city. It was occupied by some friendly Arabs, Druze, etc., who had been there about 5 months, and had cultivated the ground about there. The first time in 40 years that anyone had lived there or cultivated the ground. The women and children crowded around me, thinking me evidently just as remarkable-looking a creature as I considered them. All welcomed us to their village. When our tent was ready, I lay down on my bed and had a very nice nap, then had a walk over ruins until dinner. These ruins are gloomy in the extreme. The city, having been built of a curious black basalt, looking like and almost as hard as iron, we found but one house perfectly preserved. The porter speaks of many. At first, we were very much disappointed in the accounts he had given of these ruins, but gradually, as we inspected them more closely, felt that he had not so exaggerated as we had first thought. The houses were entirely built of this hard volcanic rock. Roofs, doors, window shutters, and even the pivots and sockets. Many of the houses have arches dividing the rooms, and all well built, and without cement or mortar, but the stones made to fit one in another. In some places, we found well-laid stone paving and fallen pillars betaking more elaborate architecture in former days. Some of the arches rested upon the pedestal of some pillar, which, at a still more ancient period, had existed. Long slabs of stone formed the roof, closely fitted together, so as to make these houses not only a shelter from the wind and rain, but also, with the heavy stone doors and shutters, a complete protection from the Bedouin. The gentlemen, with the exception of Fred, of course, tried one of the best rooms they could find for a night's shelter and sleeping place. One large room, which is in as perfect state as the day it was built, they tried, but besides the Druze occupants, there were so many fleas that they were forced to give up in despair and camp out in the open, stony ground. The next morning, bright and early, we had our breakfast set outside. The tent in the shade. This life in the open air is most delightful. 3 of the principal men of this tribe politely offered themselves as further escort in our ride of 10 hours to El Musmik, the ancient Phanius capital of Trachonitis, of which Philip was Petrarch. Our first adventure this morning was to turn the tables on the Bedouin, as it were, and frighten a solitary, wild-looking horseman, whom we saw in the distance gallop off in an opposite direction as soon as he caught sight of us. Some of our guard galloped after him and calmed his fears. I saw, for the first time, a baby camel. just as solemn, awkward, and ungainly as his mother beside whom he stood, and the baby growled as sullenly and vindictively as his elders. El Musmik, built of same black basalt rocks, the approach to it over part of the Ledja, a rocky plain. It must have been a very large city. Houses similar to those of Barak. A beautiful temple. It was originally surrounded by a colonnade, the pillars of which are lying around, and some have been placed side by side, touching each other, to form a rampart, made by at some subsequent time. There are three of the Doric columns of the portico of temples still standing. Fred made a drawing of this beautiful ruin. The interior is even more interesting than the exterior. Four of the columns which supported the stone roof, which was fallen, are standing and are ornamented near the top by a carved wreath encircling them. The stone is the same curious black basalt. I was considered a marvel to these people who made their home somewhere amid these ruins, and they crowded round me very disagreeably. Leaving El Musmik, we rode for a dreary 2 hours over a stony plain. Once came upon a large flock of goats, then upon the black tents of their owners. The chief came out of tent as we were passing near, and through our sheikh invited us, as in true Oriental style, just as they did in Abraham's time, to come down from our horses and partake of the hospitality. As this would have involved a detention of 2 hours while they killed and prepared a kid, and as we would have had to eat with our fingers or insult the Bedouin, we declined his hospitality. Whereupon, with a gesture of disdain, he left us, for in his opinion, we had transgressed the laws of politeness. We camped at night at Deir Abi, a lovely place, reached Damascus next day. May 2nd, 1868. Called with Fred and Mr. Burgum by appointment on Lady Digby, of somewhat disgraceful notoriety. The missionaries, however, say she is a repressed and repentant member and admit her to the sacrament. She is now married to a sheikh who spends part of his time in Damascus and part of it at Hooz, where rumor says he has another wife. On entering the usual apology for a door, we found ourselves in, instead of a marble court, a lovely and spacious garden with arbors and fountains and long trellised vine-covered walks paved with mosaic marble and leading off into some mysterious distances, also shady and flowery. I expected to be ushered into some palatial apartment and soon to hear the rustle of massive silk and to see approach of a bold, grand-looking lady. Instead of that, we came quite suddenly upon a lady with a light-colored serge dress, looped up in her hand, plainly made, a straw-brimmed hat on, and garden gloves. This was Lady Digby. She received us in a dignified, gracious manner, merely said she had been tying up some of her vines, and then led the way through shady paths overhung with roses in full bloom to an open room, and then at one side through a door into her salon or parlor or whatever it was called. It consisted of two rooms, divided merely by heavy curtains with her coat of arms woven in them. The rooms were furnished, semi-Oriental, semi-European, forming a very agreeable and pretty combination. But the rooms were too gaudy and rather shabby. Several wretched, dirty dogs were present and very unpleasantly familiar. Fred kindly sacrificed himself and called the dogs off from us to himself. She afterwards, upon our asking permission to see her sketches of Palmyra, led us into another room, which was her bedroom, also handsomely but gaudily furnished. The double bed, English, for only single beds are used here, was placed in a raised dais, and it was approached by several broad carpeted steps. Bed hung and covered with crimson damask, the sketches, though evidently doctored up, were very fine and well worth the visit. Coffee was served to us as usual. She showed us the photograph of the Sheikh. Lady Digby, a tall, large, fine-looking woman, hair dyed and a false black front, blue eyes, eyelids blackened in Oriental manner, a masculine face, but very interesting. Hotel crowded at this time, Monsieur Groupil and his party occupying the parlor and taking their meals in the open room. Weather very cold indeed. Lady Ely's party sit near us at meals, one of the gentlemen quite intelligent. Left on 4th May for Baalbek, Mr. Bergham photographer with us. 5 parties left for B, same day. We got off much the earliest, lunched at Ein Fidje, beautiful scenery. One of the most remarkable fountains in Syria bursts forth from a narrow cave under an old temple. The waters came leaping and foaming from this narrow prison with a roar like the sea. It is one of the sources of the Barada, ancient and very curious temple here. Mountains very lofty and precipitous, barren and beautifully tinted. The verdure, trees, grass, grain, etc., and gay flowers, which follow the course of the stream, all wonderfully vivid in color, and with the gray temple and white foaming waters, make a lovely picture. Past first night at Souk Wadi Barada, the ancient Abila of the province of Abilan. All the travelers who came up after us encamped here. High wind blew some of the people's tents over. Ours stood firm. Valley in which the village stands very lovely. Mountains more black than ever. Fred and Mr. B went up mountain near us to see Abel's tomb, which is 30 feet long. He must have been a tall youth. Mahometans worship him as a saint. Anything of value placed there is safe. No one will steal it. Next morning, beautiful ride through wild passes in mountains and over plains near which the stream fell about 20 feet. Very pretty. Then, over fertile plain of Zebedani. These Syrian streams scatter riches wherever they go, and their path is bestream with flowers. And on up the heights through lanes fringed with fragrant hawthorn to Sergaya, where we lunched. Very cold. Much snow on mountains. Nejim said in winter this was a very cold place. Passed night in a valley near a lovely swift stream. Murmur of waters to soothe us to sleep. Up early next morning and ascended steep mountains. When we ascended the upland plains, saw very fine view of Lebanon, snow-topped green valley and red and gray sides of mountains. In morning light, the variety of tints was surprising. Fred sketched. Reached Baalbek, May 6th, before noon, ahead of the other travelers. Ruins wonderful, but first 3 days I was so indisposed as to not be able to enjoy them. Fred delighted at the beauty and extent and cyclopean masonry of these wonderful remains of a departed grandeur and intelligence. About a dozen or more parties have come and gone during our stay here. During the day, the tents are hot, so Fred had an upper room of a ruined castle near our encampment cleaned and arranged for my comfort. I have to ascend to it on a ladder. There are lovely views of the ruined temples with their beautiful columns, the noble Lebanon Valley, and also the tops of the anti-Lebanon from another window. Here, in this cool retreat, we lunch, and I work, read, write, or recline on my couch, or gaze from the windows, while Fred is off sketching, working hard, poor fellow. I rode a camel yesterday for the first time. Could scarcely keep on. Do not like the motion. Fred is just now sketching the identical camel. Mr. Bergham felt sick, so returned to Beirut. May 13th. I am once more ensconced in my cool, pleasant room. Dear Fred is working away in the hot sun, for he is anxious to get through in order to leave tomorrow, as my illness continues. I am very weak. Last evening, Fred sent to the tents of a French party to beg some medicine, which they kindly sent by their dragoman. But the medicine which did me the most good was a delightful letter from Mama, giving me news of dear baby and herself. Man brought letter from Stasser. How very thankful we should be to our Heavenly Father for all his mercies. One of my favorite hymns is this: O Lord, how happy should one be if we could cast our care on thee, if we from self could rest and feel at heart that one above, in perfect wisdom, perfect love, is working for the best. The beginning of the second verse, how far from this our daily life, is most true of me, for I am sadly wanting in faith. I have been so anxious about baby all this time that the good shepherd was watching over my little lamb. Lord, give me faith and grace. May 29th, Aegean Sea, Grecian Archipelago, lovely day, sailing most delightfully here, these beautiful islands. This morning stopped at Rhodes, quaint and picturesque city and beautiful island, must be very fine scenery in interior. Innumerable windmills. Past Syria. Fine mountains on every side, precipitous down to very water's edge. Sea wonderfully blue. All well. Past Patmos, Samos, Mytilene, etc. Reached Smyrna, May 30th. Sail down the beautiful bay, very fine. Our pleasant fellow passengers, the Viscount Sandon, wife and friends, Mr. and Mrs. Roland Smith, left us here and took passage for Athens. Lord Sandon, a charming, unassuming man, gave us his card, address, 39 Grasmere Square, London, asked us to call. We went ashore. Found city rather pretty and quaint, but hot, and streets tiresome. Went to American Consul. Houses more European. Cherries very plentiful. Bought 3 Smyrna rugs in bazaar. I laugh at Fred about them. Heard afterwards that the brigands have become very troublesome lately. Seized son of Swedish Consul from their country seat, and a ransom of 15,200 English pounds had to be paid for him. Travelers cannot even go up to the castle crowning the hill over the city, for fear of the brigands. The bay here very gay, with steamers and innumerable vessels, little boats with painted prows and painted sails. Fishermen more Italian in their aspect. Very beautiful women seen in gardens of Smyrna. Baby so well yesterday, but today seems poorly. May 31st. Baby well again. June 1st. Left Smyrna. Reached Mytilene late twilight. Mountainous, lovely in the evening light. Past Chios. In morning, stopped for a few moments at Tonodos on opposite shore. Saw Alexander Ida's mountain, in distance over the level plain of Troy, with the tombs of Hector and Achilles. Soon after, entered the Dardanelles, against a current that runs to the southward at a rate of 3 or 4 miles an hour. We were disappointed in these celebrated straits. There are 2 fortifications on either side, one quite a village, which are very picturesque. June 3rd. Early in morning, I went on deck about 2 hours too soon to get the first glimpse of Constantinople. When we did come upon it, by the picturesquely fitful light of a cloudy sunrise, I was amply repaid for my early habits. Some of the passengers, by remaining in their berths, missed the first effects. Miss Park, the inevitable, came upon the scene of action certainly half an hour too late, but with her usual peculiarity, insisted that she was sure she had not missed anything. The city, with its domes, etc., and with dark cypress trees coming often in beautiful contrast against the white, tapering minarets, its beautiful situation, the dancing waters of the Bosphorus, the fairy-like caix that seemed scarcely to touch the waves, the pretty little prince's islands, the wooded hillsides of the Bosphorus, the picturesque wooden houses, the upper story projecting, and the marble palaces hung right close to the water's edge. With the life and stir of many vessels and innumerable caiques, with their picturesque oarsmen and the little smart ferry boats which constantly fly up and down these waters, all combine to make Constantinople very beautiful and wonderfully interesting. We were there a week, and every moment was occupied and full of interest. Stopped at Miseri's Hotel, fine view from our window onto Bosphorus waters on opposite side, still finer view from the roof of part of hotel where we used to go to see the city by moonlight. Mr. Hubble, ever a pleasant American clergyman who had been our fellow traveler from Beirut, had landed before us and secured rooms for us as the city was crowded. The more we saw of Mr. H., the more we liked him. Strawberries, cherries, and all kinds of beautiful flowers, very abundant in Constantinople. Of course, we were in the quarter called Pera, the European part of this large city, since Europeans are not permitted to reside either in Scutari or Istanbul. Turks almost universally have adopted the European costume, still, however, adhering to their beloved red tarbush. The Turkish women are also compromising their dress, but with them it is the headdress which is undergoing a change. They are no longer the closely veiled creatures they ever used to be, but a very thin gauze covering over the head and a square of some material covering the lower part of face. The beautiful eyes remained exposed, and indeed, this thin white appears over their nose, mouth, and chin, only enhances their beauty, and renders once a plain face pretty. Their dress is of the brightest colors, generally plain, scarlet, orange, purple, a dazzling blue, very loose and shapeless. Yellow slippers often complete this ugly costume, the head being the only pretty part. The European women of Pera have hideously exaggerated the Paris fashions. The bazaars of Istanbul are exceedingly interesting, very extensive, etc., intricate. I do not think I could ever find any way in them. They are very tempting, and you are sure to be tempted to purchase. The walking to sea sites is very fatiguing, but the pleasant little excursions in the caiques rest you and are delightful, giving you such lovely views of this fairy city. We went in one of those over to Santari to see the howling dervishes. Very curious, but much less painful or merry than I had anticipated. Also went to see whirling dervishes. This, curious, and more graceful and impressive. Building much finer than that of the howling dervishes. The priest of these latters was an earnest, interesting-looking man, and the most interesting part of that day's exercises to us was the sight of this priest's most beautiful little boy, quaintly dressed in a sobering colored silk hose dress like those of his elders, who came in, most unexpectedly to us, quietly and solemnly, and placed himself beside his grave father, first kissing that father's hand, as all the devotees had done. His glorious dark eyes and lovely earnest face are never to be forgotten.